February 14th, 2012 is the Watt from Pedro Show.
right out that tree. Had the curling wire. Boy, how that spiel inspired. Knocked me out, now I was slayed. Changed forever from that day. Sang to me some Creighton song. I was bass man from then on. I'm a lucky man. Know that man, hell of a man, boiler man. Boy, oh boy, boiler man. Boy, boy, boiler, boiler man. Hell with you, I think I can make it. Curious mind, discussing all the time. Outsiders looking in, wondering what, why, and when. Who were the frauds who held the purse? What was our labor worth? Well, you worked that six string strong, filled our engine room with song. I'm a lucky man. Know that man, hell man, boy, 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 man, boy, 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 man. Together with you, I think I can make it. Just like a chess game, reenact a puzzle, parallel our struggle. First out loud with belly laughs, live each day like it's our last. With you here I had no fear, made all my reasons clear. I'm a lucky man. That man, hell man, a boiler man. Boy, oh boy, a boiler man. Boy, boy, boiler, boiler man. Together with you, I think we can. I love you, man.
Start off the show with John Coltrane doing the 7-inch single version of My Favorite Things, both sides A and B, as you could tell. Then you heard Sawako with Water Travel. Then you heard The Boiler Man from my first opera, Contemplate in the Engine Room. Our guest today, Nick Reinhardt, calling us from his pad near Sacto. When did music enter your mind as a child?
Well, my dad played guitar, and I remember I would kind of fart around on his acoustic, and he would show me little things here and there when I was probably 10 years old. And he lived out in Moorpark, in the valley, in SoCal. And I was up here, up north, with my mom, and so I'd visit, you know, a few times a year and hang out. And every time I'd go over, you know, he'd kind of show me some new stuff on his acoustic, and he had this kind of a crappy Yamaha electric guitar that I'd mess around with, too, and he had a cool, like, old, you know, Fender Classic something or other amp. And I remember just thinking that was, like, a really cool thing, you know, get to do at Dad's house. And then when I was 11, Christmas of... whatever, I guess maybe 94, my stepbrother got a guitar for Christmas from my dad and my stepmom. He got a blue Memphis Strat copy, and I remember I was so obsessed with, you know, what he got for Christmas. Of course, I don't remember what I got, but I remember what my brother got. And so that was kind of like the beginning of it for me, is just playing on his guitar. I remember I played it more than he did that year. And then eventually I saved up all the money that I had gotten for that Christmas, and I bought my own guitar probably 3 months later or something. But that was probably the beginning of, like, wow, music is rad. This is what I want to do. Like, I remember my mom really, really was trying to get me to do, like, soccer and play sports, you know, as an 11- and 12-year-old, and I was kind of really pissy about that because, you know, I just wanted to skateboard and play guitar, and so that kind of just became my thing, I guess, from really, really super early on.
Was there music stuff in your mind? Like a record or some crap? Something on TV, on the radio, something at school?
I don't really remember being obsessed with music before the age of 11. I remember my very first concert ever was Michael Jackson with my parents. Yeah. And I remember that. That was a trip. I think I was 5 or 6 years old.
Damn.
And I the reason I specifically recall things from that is just because it was so insane. It was an crazy show, as you could imagine. But I remember specifically at that show, I remember my mom was getting mad at the guy in front of us because he was, like, standing up during the intro or whatever. And I remember my mom yelling at him to sit down, and the guy turns around and says, or my mom says, "Sit down, we can't see." And then the guy turns around and says, "There's nothing to see," or whatever. But it's this really, really bizarre memory I remember from, I think I was taken, but at that point I was familiar with Michael Jackson, obviously, you know, like, I guess that was around the time Thriller had come out. And I actually still have the little tour book that we bought from there. So I remember being interested in that, and there was a really cool show, you know, with, like, the whole Thriller thing with monsters and zombies and all that. And that was probably, like, one of my first musical memories was the Michael Jackson stuff.
Yeah, I can't remember a lot from 5 or 6. But, okay, Mike Jackson, where was it? Was it here, SoCal, or up there?
Yeah, it was somewhere in SoCal. I wouldn't remember where it was, but I was living down there at the time.
So you saw some gigs. Did you see any other gigs after that?
I think that was, like, the very first real thing
I did.
And then it was probably when I was 12.
Also, post the guitar thing.
I finally get my own guitar. I think by that time, I remember another really defining moment was probably 11, being at my grandma's house and seeing the Anarchy in the UK video on MTV. And that was another, like, whoa, what the fuck, blew my mind. And I remember, this is actually funny, I can remember this really well. My uncle walks in, and he sees me watching this video, and I'm freaking out over it. And he goes, "Oh, hold on a second, you got to see this." And he tells me about The Greatest Rock and Roll Swindle. He's like, "You got to see the Sex Pistols movie, it'll blow your mind." And so I remember he said he had a copied VHS of it, and so we tore the house apart looking for it. And he didn't end up finding it, but he told me all about it, and it wasn't until years later that I was able to find a copy and check it out for myself. But that was another, like, really defining moment for me. I guess that was probably my first introduction to just punk music.
Yeah, that was pretty righteous of him. How old was he?
He was probably, I guess, actually, he was about probably close to my age. I'm 28 now, so he must have been probably, 28, 29.
Yeah.
Seeing his little nephew watch the Sex Pistols. Yeah. And then shortly after that, when I was 12, so this was post-guitar, post, you know, finally understanding.
Post-toasties.
Yeah, exactly. My dad took me to Lollapalooza in Irvine, and I guess that must have been 94, 95 with Sonic Youth, and that was the first time I'd seen them, and that was, like, another thing that just kind of blew my mind out there, whatever. Yeah, I think that was 95.
That's your second gig?
I believe so, yeah. I think that was probably my first, like, real rock concert was Lollapalooza.
Damn. Well, let's hold on a second. Let's play some music.
Sure.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show. Started off that chunk of music with some Termelos, which is Mr. Nick Reinhardt's band, and a tune called 555-9676, which was probably a phone number, maybe.
Yeah, I remember that one.
That was a tradition in the swing band days. They had there's several songs with phone numbers. So I think people met each other at dances in Pennsylvania, whatever. They did numbers different in those days because you had exchanges and stuff.
Sure.
And then we heard Elvis Never Didn't Die by the End of Tonight. And I picked that because it's part of the record that other tune's on. You guys split an album?
Yeah, we met this band called By the End of Tonight. God, I don't know what year that was. Must have been probably 5 years ago now. They were this rad, instrumental, kind of like freaky band based out of Texas, and they were on a cool label called Temporary Residence. And so we had met them and done a little bit of touring with them and became good friends and said, hey, you know, let's end up doing a split, which actually ended up being more of a double EP because we each had like 5 or 6 songs on it or something. So, yeah, those are good buds of ours.
Yeah, I didn't want to confuse people because we're getting ahead of the story. I just wanted to play some music. Then we heard In the Flow, something live from Fig. Do you know about Fig? It's a new band.
I'm not familiar with them.
Okay, it's got 2 members, Nels Klein, Yuka Honda. And I got to be at the first gig. Dose was playing at their first gig. And then we heard somebody you know, I think, Marnie Stern with the Crippled Jazz or something live. And then finally, Expelled by Bygones. Now this time, how old were you at the Lollapalooza? 15?
No, I think I would have been probably 12.
Still, so it's around this time. Okay.
Yeah, I'm thinking 12.
So you just got the guitar.
Right. Yes, I'm playing guitar. You know.
And how you doing? Are you like trying to copy records, like I did, like an idiot? Are your pops showing you stuff?
I think at that point, I had, you know, discovered punk music, and that was like I was a Nirvana kid and a grunge, you know, little skate rat.
Yeah.
So at that point, I think I was just kind of like, you know, yeah, probably copying a lot of punk records and Nirvana stuff, and maybe some Metallica things here and there. But definitely, it had not even crossed my mind, not even till years later, that I could write my own songs or even conceptually have a band doing this stuff. That didn't come into play till many years later.
Yeah, so you're just trying to like do what you're hearing, try to get some things going. Yeah. What about people at school? Did anybody want to you want to play with anybody? Anybody else playing? You're talking like beginning of junior high school, right?
Yeah, so this was between 6th and 8th grade. I had no friends that, you know, had instruments. I knew one guy that had another guitar. But, again, even the idea of jamming together, that wasn't even, for some reason, it never crossed my mind that, oh, let's write music or, you know, here's a song that has 2 guitar parts. Let's learn to play them together. It was really strange. That never crossed my
guitars,
mind to do that.
It's man alone mission.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like it was a personal thing for me. It was just like, oh, yeah, I get home from school and play in my bedroom and, you know, here's this Nirvana song that I kind of figured out how to play and, you know, just basically went about it that way.
But you saw them cats had other guys in the bands.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You just ain't put it together yet, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it took me a long time to even think about that. And I remember in 7th grade, by that point I was living full-time in Sacramento with my mom, and there were these 2 punker dudes. I went to a pretty, like, dicey middle school for 7th grade, and there was 2 dudes with, you know, torn pants and weird hair, and I kind of gravitated towards them. And I remember them talking about, you know, a quote-unquote band that they were doing. But still, it was like, whoa, I don't – can we do that? Are we allowed to – like, are we good enough? I don't understand how the band thing works, you know. But little did I know that, well, that's what all the punk shit was based off of, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I can understand in a way, because if you don't have a punk with so much against, a reaction against something, if you don't know what it's against, it's kind of hard to find a context for it. So
right.
I don't blame you for not knowing. But that's a trip. These two cats. So you start jamming with them.
Well, they had jammed together, and I remember one of them telling me a story about they had played a party, and keep in mind, this is seventh graders, and these are dudes that are tripped out with dreaded hair with, you know, pink and green in it and all that shit, and so this was like a really weird thing for me, and by that point, I hadn't really been exposed to, like, that whole scene. I listened to punk music, but I wasn't familiar with the aesthetic, really, that came along with it, and what people did, you know, and so that was a trip, just being around those guys. But no, I never ended up jamming with them.
Oh, it was just the cultural thing.
Yeah, it was more, yeah, exactly. It was just the cultural thing that really opened my eyes to this weirdo fucking culture going on that I didn't even know existed outside of, you know, I guess the Anarchy in the UK video.
Okay, let's hear some more music. We got some more weird Nels Klein music.
Hmm.
Much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Atlas on this star-studded Montauk beach, bleached night of dead cartilage, rotting, haunting puzzles to their core. Straddle night space glazed with numbered stars to each pebble on the shore. If you stand and throw your great knife, and cut an imaginary line through the night sky. It is said that space is so vast that no star would be hit. Surrealism's magic master, Beachcomber, leaves lines like Spider-Man spit on skyscrapers, Gotham's duo, Batman, Robin, and the rest. Where Montauk descendants sell tobacco, leave your signals to predict, and keyboard specialists to plunder the growing algebraic garden of poppies, not having heard such names as Tanguy or Charles Henri, who before computers had seen the fractal pattern curl back upon themselves as clean and easy as a cut through space. A thread in a Persian rug, or a seahorse dancing in the pride of the deep ocean. The course lives in the dance, in the footprints, in the throne of worlds, the gnomon of Sisera sits upon myth and geometry meet in the mouth and in the maw, or in carcasses washed ashore, where he sits in quick poppy's charm. In the kitchen's lost creations, raw foods, no more fine blade, slicing symmetry of the seed or chopping herbs. Latex oozing from the night like a field of Milky Way's frozen eternal footsteps above the Dakota. The space-time sung anew, like the canaries do, and bebop too, to sing, to save their memories, wait for flight. The brain lightens, and ideas are boats untied, left in the currents of neurons, lest fantasized postulates school kids study, while long-bladed orbits, assassins, lovers, when the bare light moon dims the sunroom, unexplained, resonating, unscrewed, unfurnished with a future by transient festal vacancies of the past. Sing for us. Play for us. Pray for our minimalistic souls while we sit in our Acuras watching manipulators coasting in Manhattan on rollerblades of black ice.
A lot from Pedro show. You just heard Charles Henry Ford's Last Prince, a poem read live by Mr. Charlie Plymell. Before him, William Carlos Williams doing the Red Wheelbarrow. Ahead of that was a portrait by Sam Sebring. A Fight at Jazz Night by the Nice Sharp Pencils. That's a band I got to play with in England this last tour in the fall. It's just bass player and drummer. And great cats. This man named Ben, he put on the gig. It was like, kind of like the old days. Talk about the aesthetics. And his sister helped make a chow for us. And yeah, it was a great gig. He's an incredible musician, too. A terribly nice guy. And then we started out with Thurston County, something live by the Nels Klein Singers. It's a new version, or newer version, that doesn't have Devin Hoff anymore on bass. They've got this guy, Trevor Dunn. He was Cali, I think, like around Eureka or something. Somewhere in NorCal. But he lives in New York City now. Incredible bass player. You want to take it further?
Yeah, that's about where it started. And so those were like my closest friends for a year. And then I moved away from there into kind of this little suburban area. And that was in, like, Sacramento proper, sketchy little neighborhood, you know, apartments getting broken into and all that shit. And then my parents moved me into kind of the suburbs, so that was an even bigger trip because it was like I was in this war zone, you know, for seventh grade, and then just kind of moved back into this kind of sheltered little suburban community type thing.
Yeah. And on the music front, what are you doing now? Are you really jamming?
So
you're Man Alone still, right?
Man Alone still, right. And then make a couple of really close friends in eighth grade. And then it was ninth grade when I got into high school that I finally, you know, we figured out, a couple friends and myself, like, whoa, we can make music. You have you bought a drum set and we'll go get this mic. I remember we went to a little swap meet, and we bought some speakers and like a mic and a mic cable or something, and you know, put it all together, and then officially, you know, wrote our very first song or whatever it was. So that was probably about, I'd say, 14 years old that we finally actually, like, we're all in a room together and calling ourselves a band, you know.
How'd you pick these cats? They picked you?
We were all just kind of like the weirdos at school. You know, that skateboarded and did funky stuff. And I think those guys saw that, oh, you know, this guy has a guitar. Let's just see about us getting instruments. And then so everyone just kind of like...
You instigated them.
I guess so, yeah.
That's great. You infected them.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and so you guys are jamming now after school.
Yeah, so we're jamming after school.
How did they pick which they wanted? This is interesting for me. How did they pick which one was going to do what? Because you already had your deal.
Right. So one of them, I guess, just gravitated towards playing drums. So my friend Ben ended up with a drum set. And then his brother kind of knew how to play guitar, but wasn't very good. So he just ended up, you know, with a mic in his hand. Singing.
He was a singer. So yeah, there's no bass man.
No, we didn't have a bass man. We just kind of had friends that would play every once in a while with us.
Okay.
Healthy bystanders.
So the core was you three cats.
Right, yeah.
A brother team.
Yeah. And then that eventually turned into you know, brother singing, didn't end up wanting to do it anymore. Then we found a real bass player, and then I started playing guitar and singing. And that's when it became like a real quote-unquote band. Demo and pressed a bunch of CDs ourselves and started playing shows and all that.
Wow. So you're writing songs.
Yeah, so that was probably at about 16 that it finally happened, where it's like, oh, we're a real band writing songs with a shitty CD that we made, you know, and
high school. First year of high school?
Yeah, probably about between first and second year, that was when that all happened.
Do you remember your first songs you wrote with these guys?
I can actually remember the very, very first song that I ever wrote.
What's your first songs, period, right? Yeah, okay.
The very first song, I remember it was in E minor, and it actually had some pretty funky chords going on. It was kind of, I guess, pretty out there, all things considered. In fact, I can't even remember how to play the riff. I was showing it to Tarabellos the other day just for fun. But, yeah, it's a really kind of bizarre trip.
What, you want to revive it?
Yeah, no. No, I was farting around on guitar, and I was like, oh my gosh, I remember my very first guitar riff that I wrote.
And what's it called?
It was called Sober, and at the time, Matt, who was the brother, he, you know, was singing for us, and I think it was about his cousin, you know, alcoholic cousin or something, or okay, something, some dramatic thing, but I remember it being like a pretty...
Maybe some commentary.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then I think we had the second song was called The Gilded Age, which
Was
about like...
It's kind of Sophisto.
Yeah. I think it was like about, you know, consumerism or just something like that. I don't exactly remember. But, yeah, those were the earliest songs.
Interesting. We're at the end of the first hour of the Valentine Day, February 14th, 2012, edition of Watt from Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour two. February 14th, 2012, it's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. Thank you. Okay, we start off the second hour there with Ghost of the Pinata from the Nels Klein Singers. This is the, I guess, the classic version, or the only other version before now. This had Devin Hoff on the stand-up bass. And then we heard The Werewolf and Ben by Tara Melos. In the music journey, Nick Reinhardt, guest today, he's already now written songs. In fact, a CD does exist. We got to get a hold of this somehow so we can hear these tunes. Lucky yeah. for me, I get to hear my first tunes because they were terrible.
Hey, mine are pretty awful.
But okay, does this band make it through high school?
No. So this band breaks up, whatever, blah blah blah. You know, whatever it was, and actually, right when this band was breaking up is when I met Nathan Latona, bass player for Tara Melos.
Yeah.
And I had put up an ad in a record store saying, you know, looking for a bass player to jam with, blah, blah, blah. And so
he responded. Was it a bad breakup?
Yeah, there was drama.
Okay.
You know.
So you wanted to get right back into another band, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I meet Nate, and I had some friends that were in an even better punk band than our shitty punk band, this band called No Regard, and they needed another guitar player and a bass player, and I said, hey, why don't I come play with you, and I just met this guy, and he's rad, let's come jam. And so then we joined this other punk band, and that was probably our main band for... I guess that would have been from about junior or senior year till about maybe 2003 when we started Tara Melos. So yeah, so then we kind of joined this other band and played for that for a few years.
And that's your second band?
Yeah, wow. That was our second band.
Had he been in some bands?
I think he was probably something similar to me, where it was just kind of like kids messing around, but... You know, not real bands playing shows without, you know, real recordings and stuff. So
well, Innocent,
I think we are kind of on the same page.
Innocent Bystander had a recording, but you guys didn't do gigs.
Well, we played a few gigs.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
What were those like?
We played probably really junky. I remember...
Well, like keggers, you know, in the backyard or something?
Exactly, literally. You know, part out, we would just... get our gear and go set up at a park and find an outlet and plug in and play.
Oh, wow.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, going to Gorilla. Yeah. Was there a club scene? Were you guys going to club? I mean, you're young, so you're not really going to... Was there all ages shows?
Yeah. Okay. Actually, you know Bojangles?
Sure.
Cattle Club.
Cattle
that
Club.
That was our very first, like, my very first... experience with club shows, because that was an all-ages spot.
Yeah, that's right. For you people out there, the Sacramento area, that's where you saw the punk shows in those days up there. I didn't realize there was all-ages shows, but there was. Yeah. Brian McKenna.
Yeah, exactly. And then shortly after I had started going to shows there... it shut down, or there was a fire, or something happened, and all the local, like, rad, all-ages, punk, weird shows moved to a place called the Capitol Garage in downtown Sacramento. So that was then the spot for probably the next 7 or 8 years or something for all the awesome shows.
Wow. Wow. Now, No Regard, you guys are... It's not really your band. You guys join these guys, right?
Right, exactly.
So what, they're like writing the tunes and...
Yeah, like, they were writing songs. I think we did demos. We made a couple of EPs and just gave them to our friends and stuff. We never played we played one show out of town. We played in San Rafael once. And that was like our one out of town gig. We were kind of like, you know, the local band that jumped on shows and stuff. And that was a fun time, you know. That taught us a lot about writing and how
I gotta get some of that music too. See, I don't know this, but you're describing it. What was it like? It was you and Nathan and what, two other cats?
That three other dudes.
Three, okay.
And that was like a faster punk band, I guess. It would probably kind of fall into like a skate punk category, that sort of like Southern California 90s sound, I guess. You know, the really fast punk beats with sort of like thrashy / melodic guitars over it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that sort of had that type of vibe, which was new for us, because the Guilty Bystanders thing, that was just sort of like all over the place weirdness, I guess.
Not okay. Not confined by a genre.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So now how did No Regard work out for you guys?
It was I
hopefully some drama, right?
Yeah. What was the drama? I think the only drama was being in a band with dudes that, like, that wasn't in their blood to be in a band and play music. It was just a fun thing to do in high school.
Ah,
so
okay.
So once everyone got, you know, to 19 or 20, I think everyone was like, what are we doing? Why are we still doing this kind of thing? You know, that was fun for a few years, and now, like, I kind of want to have a serious girlfriend and go to college or something, you know, which is... And Nathan and I think at that point we realized, well, shit, this is, like, what we want to be doing, you know. This isn't just like a fun thing. This is like, oh fuck, every Monday we got band practice. That's all we look forward to every week, is Monday at 6 p.m. we get to go and play songs, you know, for an hour. So to us, that was like the most exciting thing going on in our lives. And I think for the other guys, it was just sort of like a fun little hobby to do for a while.
Okay, hold that thought. We got some more music. Watch for Pedro show. That was Wails and Echoes by Solo Musica. Ahead of that was Chewing Gum by the Bad Meds. That's got the bassman from Hot Club de Paris. That's who we got to play with the nice sharp pencils. Some connections here I didn't realize. And we start off with Television by Helios Creed. Helios Creed was at my gig last week. He had a band in San Francisco called Chrome in the 70s. I don't know if you remember, but I hadn't seen him in many years. In fact, the last place I saw him was in Lawrence, Kansas. And now he's going to make an album, and he asked me to do some bass on it. So that's a trip. Helios. He was downtown here at the Redwood, and I played him the third opera. At first, you know, he asked me what's it going to be like. I said, well, it's one song, it's 45 minutes. He goes, what, thick as a brick? You know this? This is like a Jethro Tull album from the old days. Funny, funny thing. So, back to your journey. You and Nathan, you want to do more than you want to do even more than Monday nights for crack.
Right. And I think that was about the time that he and I had kind of discovered Fugazi and were starting to like really kind of get out of the whole, oh, we're playing just fast punk songs thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember we started kind of bringing these weirder kind of, well, I guess for the time and the context, these far out riffs and songs to the band that the band was kind of, I guess it was confusing them and they weren't really into it. And so I think that kind of freaked everyone out, and that basically just put the nail in the coffin for that original band.
Okay. So what was the next step? Let's do our own.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so then it was, okay, so we don't have a band anymore, but this is what we really want to be doing. Let's, you know, you come to my house a few nights a week. We'll start writing music together and see what happens. It was actually, I think that must have been 2001, maybe 2002, 2003, somewhere right in there. I think it was 2001 that I first saw the band Hella. And that was like a really another just fucking bizarre musical landmark for me that totally changed, you know, the way I was hearing things and thought what was possible to do with music. And I also heard another band called the Dillinger Escape Plan at that time, which was this really, really fast, thrashy, technical, like, I guess, metal band. And so between those two bands and having the punk background and...
This is the Hella with two people.
Two-piece Hella, 2001, right when Hella came out.
Yeah.
I was at a show. A friend
I did some gigs with them then.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's 10 years ago now. Wow, that's crazy to think about that. I drove up into the mountains. I feel like it was in the mountains. It was a show in Placerville, sort of in this, I guess, more of the woods, not the mountains. But we went to see this band called Crime and Choir, which I guess we had been hearing had this awesome drummer in it, this guy named Zach Hill. And it was sort of just this instrumental kind of like lots of keyboard driven band, just sort of like electronic-y ambient sounding, and we'd been hearing about this drummer. So a friend and myself drove to Placerville to the woods to see this band play. Well, it turns out Crime and Choir, for whatever reason, couldn't play that night. So instead, the drummer, Zach Hill, had his other band play called Hella, and I think that was probably one of their really, really early shows. And then that night just totally, totally ripped my musical world open, seeing what was actually possible.
Yeah, it was a guitar and drum duo. And later on I saw him as a five-piece, but I remember that old days. Yeah, it was wild. Great band. So, this was profound on you and Nate.
Big time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then after that, we were just sort of like really inspired by all this like new stuff that we were, you know, discovering, all these cool new musical ideas, and we were like, well, that's kind of funky because we were in this punk band and started trying out these new things, and those guys just thought it was pretty bizarre and strange, and so we were kind of discouraged by that, but then we find all this neat stuff happening, so like, wow, okay, maybe we can do this.
I could give you commentary on it, but it is trippy. I saw that happen, how you could freak punks out with just weird music, where right. their scene was supposed to be weird. Here, let's hear some right. more stuff.
Protectors of goodness. She's never weak, she's queen. Running her feet through sand, pink dress and dirty hands, changing her name again and burdened by the day. Running her feet through sand, pink dress and dirty hands, changing her name again and burdened by the day. Wet middle earth, the coolness, bury the book, its secrets, finger the words, flipping the page, the colorful stories, she cannot read, but she knows, running feet through sand, pink dress and dirty hands, changing her name again and burdened by the day. Running her feet through sand, pink dress and dirty hands, changing her name again and burdened by the day. She flies, she is called, return from her throne, the sun falls, running her feet through sand, pink dress and dirty hands, changing her name again and burdened by the day. Running her feet through sand, pink dress and dirty hands, changing her name again and burdened by the day. Unburdened by the day, unburdened by the day, unburdened by the day, unburdened by the day.
Page After Page by Doe started that out. And then we heard Family by Toys That Kill. There's a cat down here named Todd. He's got a label called Recess Records, Nick. And, God, he's put out all kinds of stuff. And that's his band. He used to have a band before that called FYP. He was a pro skater when he was younger. So he has the skater-musician connect.
Right.
He's really, into recording and putting out bands. And he recorded this thing with these cats called Off With Their Heads. He didn't play, but
I'm familiar.
You know about that?
I'm familiar with that.
Well, they asked me to play bass, and it's on a 7-inch with Discharge.
Oh,
well, I didn't even know it was still around, but they are, some form or another. And so it's something that Todd put together. And then we heard Nude Love and Naked Splendor by John Truby and the Ugly Janitors of America. Now, he's a trip. He's a guy who got notoriety in the middle 80s by... There were some companies in Nashville you could send in lyrics, and they would give you a song. So he just wrote these stupid fucking words. You know, we can all hear all that shit, so everybody's going to love you when they hear the radio show, all this fumbling around you're doing. But anyway, he said these words that was like a blind man's penis, and this hokey-ass C&W band got this music, and the guy's singing, you know, you paid him money, right? It's kind of a vanity thing where you want to hear your song realized.
Right.
I guess they had no qualms about what you gave them, you know. So that's how John Truby got involved. Now this latest thing here is with the opera singer and stuff. But anyway, so you're too weird for the supposed weird guys who are kind of burning out anyway.
Exactly. So, you know, then...
And you just saw some wild music with Helen. You've heard from the East Coast, the Dillinger Escape thing with the math. It's weird, but it's got some technique.
Yeah, exactly.
And those fuckers can play.
Yeah, so that was just all really inspiring to us, and it made us really excited, you know, to actually start a new band and see what we could do with it. So we got, you know, one of our close friends who was this wacky dude who played guitar in hardcore bands, and we're like, yeah, that he would be fucking perfect. This guy named Jeff Worms. Worms was his real last name, Jeff Worms.
Good
and
pop
then,
name.
So we kind of
some
started,
guys are blessed with good punk names.
Yeah.
Oh no, yeah, like the drummer in X, his name really is Bonebreak. Yeah.
So we kind of start writing songs between the three of us.
Where did you find him? Where did you find Mr. Worms?
He was just a good friend of ours that played in local hardcore bands that we knew from shows, going to shows. And then, so we needed a drummer after we had sort of like a little set list of songs worked out. And we did not, at that point, drummers were just so rare to come by, at least good ones, because we were all like kind of focused on the musicianship of these new songs and being good at our instruments, where before we were just all just sloppy and didn't give a fuck and... That was kind of like the aesthetic, whereas now we're like, well, we're actually kind of like starting to figure out how to play well and stuff. Let's make this like a good sounding band with, you know, it'll still have the raw elements to it, but we want it to like be, you know, have an emphasis on some of the, I guess, technicality stuff that we're working on. So we didn't know any drummers that could play like that. So actually, Jeff was in an improv jazz class at the local junior college. And there was a guy in that class with him that kind of just would, I guess, you know, jam on a snare drum and maybe a cymbal for their class. And he just kind of went up to him cold and said, hey, you know, my name's Jeff. I play in this band. Would you want to come, you know, try out for us? And so that was Vince. That was our original drummer.
So you wrote the first batch of tunes without a drummer.
Yeah, we had come up with a bunch of riffs and
Me and D. Boone. Our first batch of songs with Minutemen was with no drummer. Joe Biza, we didn't know him really at the time. We see him at gigs. He's very, you could tell Joe Biza. But he talked about these two crazy guys above him. He thought we were dancing because he was trying to hold the beat with our feet. So he had no drummer. And he thought we were, but we were playing with no amplifiers. So he couldn't hear any guitars. He was just hearing all this stomping and shit. And he thought we were like dancing up a storm. So I know how it is to write the first. You can do it. People say, how do you have a band without drummers? But you can do it. It's hard to play gigs.
Yeah.
Here, we're at the end of the second hour. Watt from Pedro Show, February 14, 2012. Hold tight for hour three. February 14, 2012. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
As I sit on the porcelain throne, my bowels are aching and beginning to moan, dumping for knowledge while I read my porn. Out of my ass comes a shit pack of corn.
I said, "Adieu, mamma mia." I got a chronic case of diarrhea. I wake up with some stomach gas, sitting on the toilet, blasting from my ass. You can smell my needle vapor. I hope there's enough toilet paper. It's the first shit of the morning, the first shit of the day, the first shit of the morning bombs away. The first shit of the morning, the first shit of the day. Thank God I'm a hetero, not gay. In the morning, we go to the John at the truck stop. You can hear the echo of the shit kerplop. It doesn't matter if there's a door there. I'll take a shit even if people stare. The first shit of the morning. The first shit of the day. Yeah! The first shit of the morning. There's another log on its way. Yeah! The first shit of the morning. The first shit of the day.
Start off the third hour with Melody 9 by Tara Melos, followed by First Shit in the Morning by El Duce, who was the brains behind the Mentors. And then finally, The Blessing of the Dawn Source by Sproton Layer, which is Roger Miller's early band when he was a younger man. Yeah, you say Roger Miller in the older days, yeah, they think. But King of the Road. Ain't that Roger Miller? Isn't that right? I can't remember. Anyway, this is the one from, what are they called? My Academy. They've gotten back together, in fact, Dud Gigs.
Mission
of Burma.
Right. Yeah.
Terrible memory sometimes. Yeah, Mission Burma. This was Roger with his brothers when he was younger. I think they made a band with all three brothers called M. And like I was telling you, Roger, Ron Ashton knew these people in Ann Arbor. And they said the Millers were very interesting people. So, Mr. Worms, your guitarist, he's kind of coerced this drummer man because of the incredible display of snare drum manship at the junior college, and how did you get him to do the drum beat? You said, here's the tunes. Now, what would you play, or did you tell him what to play? Or?
Well, actually, that was the really curious part, and that was like another like monumental moment musically for me, was because he was like a jazz guy. He played jazz music, and he came in and we had showed him these riffs that we had, and he was able to kind of explain to us that they were in these funky time signatures. And I remember specifically there was one riff that we would play, and he showed us, well, yeah, that's in 7/8, and he explained to us what 7/8 meant, and he played a 4/4 beat over a 7/8 guitar riff, and there was all this weird syncopation and strangeness happening with how it locks in together that I had never experienced before. And that was probably the first time I was like, whoa, so that's how that works. Whoa. And so that was kind of a mind blowing thing. So he actually kind of just brought it himself and was able to create, you know, these really interesting, cool patterns and drum things to these songs that we had come up with.
Wow. And, you know, you guys are coming out of the 4/4 oompa.
Right.
But you say no without listening to Frank Zappa or Captain Beefheart.
Yeah, at that point, and I know that's like a really weird thing, I think, for people to grasp that weren't just like ripping these bands. It was really just out of the necessity to write interesting music. Like I had mentioned, at that point we had heard bands like Hella and were massive Fugazi fans by that point, and so we knew that it existed, but the reason that those bands spoke to us was because we noticed that we shared something similar with them and that we were trying to do something interesting, you know. And so then it was at that point that all this other music occurred to us, like, oh wow, okay, so this is how it all works. There are bands that do this sort of thing, you know, and it has existed for a long time.
Yeah. You come up with the name.
Yep, before our very first show.
Right, during the prax, getting this thing together. And you say the first gig went over really well.
Yeah, we just played instrumentally. We hadn't had a singer at that point, and we just wanted to start playing shows because we woodshedded in the practice spot for probably a year.
Wow.
And then decided, okay, we're probably ready to like play a show. We played our first show at Capitol Garage, maybe in 2003, I think. I'm kind of fuzzy with the dates, but yeah, it was a really fun show. People seemed to dig our band, so we said, okay, well, let's start booking more shows. And shortly after that, then, you know, it even was more clear to us what we could do as a band. None of us had ever toured before, so we said, okay, well, why don't we actually try booking ourselves a tour, and booked our very first DIY tour that was, I think, down to San Diego and back. I think it was 2 weeks long, and there was probably eight shows tops in there.
But this is after the first gig.
Yeah, after our first gig. Yep.
All right. All right. Here, let's hear some music. Thank you.
You between. Never, 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 never gonna, never gonna. The queen, the honor, honor queen. That the one, yeah. I'm on the street.
Wow.
la 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 la.
Watt for Pedro show. You just heard part two, September 12th, 1998. That's something live from Kim Gordon, Yashimi, and DJ Olive, New York City, I think at the Cooler. And ahead of that was Nels Klein and Greg Bendian doing Lonnie's Lament, which is a John Coltrane, of course, did that tune. What about recording? You guys already planned this first tour.
Well, so we wanted something to be able to give to people on the tour to remember us by, you know. So we had actually demoed, I think, 4 or 5 songs at that point that were instrumental, but were created with the intent of giving them to potential, you know, singers for our band. So there were these songs that were supposed to have vocals on them.
Yeah.
That were just demos. But we said, well, okay, fuck it. Let's just, you know, hand print a bunch of these and, you know, sell them for $2, you know, at shows. So, yeah. So
sure.
Our very first tour, we were selling these junky demos that we had. And that was, I guess, technically our very first recording.
Oh, wow. Is that thing available? You see, you have any of those left?
Yes.
Damn.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear
around.
That.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is there a big difference? Does it have the heart of the Taramelo sound? Could you tell?
You know, it's funny. I haven't listened to those things, any of those songs, in years. It's the kind of thing where fans of our band have found them online and kind of like in weird ways covet them and like, oh my god, the first demo is so good, blah blah blah. And of course I hear it and I'm like, oh fuck man, this sucks. But I mean, it's probably an interesting just, you know, piece of history for the band. But I think it does contain, you know, the soul and the elements of what the band is and what the band, you know, represents. But it's just not done the way that we had intended for.
Yeah, well, you're just starting. It's baby steps.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the next step after that mini tour, after doing this demo?
So then I think we probably did a few more shitty mini tours and then made our very first real record in a real studio that we were all happy with. And that's the one. It doesn't have a name. It's the one with the chainsaw guys on the front of it.
Yeah.
And so that's our very first record. Did that. That came out, toured more. Then, I guess, just kind of fast forward through the history, Jeff Worms quits the band.
Yeah.
Band becomes a 3-piece and gets even more experimental and thrash. And then we did an EP called The Drugs to the Dear Youth.
Yeah, we should talk about this a little bit. The pedals, are they in the picture by this point?
They were just getting there all with all the crazy effects and stuff. They weren't there.
Because you're trying crazy stuff with your guitar phrase. You already talked about time and so you're in the riffs.
Right.
And the chords. And now you're bringing in.
After Jeff quit, I remember feeling like, okay, I kind of want to fill up some more room, some musical space sonically and technically. So I kind of started acquiring new pedals and realizing, okay, I can make a lot more noise with these little boxes. At that point, I probably had like three or four that I was using. And then I started, you know, amassing a lot more and then kind of linked them all together and realized, oh, okay, wow, we can make a lot of fucking sound with all these pedals. So then that was when we made the second EP, which was the Drugs to the Dear Youth one, that started containing some of like the more like experimental guitar sounds and stuff.
Okay. Same drummy?
Same drummer, right. So we do the Drugs to the Dear Youth EP, two or more, get home, write some more songs. Then we did the By the End of Tonight split, which we kind of discussed a little bit earlier. That was our first true experimentation with vocals, which I did on that record. Toured some more, wrote some more songs. Then at that point, jazz drummer man Vince, he quits the band. Then Nate and I are just completely fucked. What are we going to do? We're back to where we were, you know, 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago when the punk band broke up.
After No Regard.
Exactly. It's just you and me again, bud.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
So, cycled through.
Yeah, exactly. And so then we just, at that point, we were established enough to where, you know, we had friends all over the country. And so we just put the word out, like, hey, we need a new rad drummer. And we had a lot of awesome responses come in. People were sending us videos, emails, posting stuff on YouTube and all that. And then we eventually just kind of crossed paths with our current drummer, John Clardy.
Yeah.
And then the rest is history.
Right, right. He's been with you since.
Yeah, so it's been about probably...
Now, John's a guy who lives in Texas.
Yeah, he's out of Dallas-Fort Worth area, Texas. Mm-hmm.
So prac must be hard. Monday night prac must be tough.
Yeah, no more Monday night practice. We just kind of like, you know, do the whole fly him out thing. And actually right now he's out here right now and we're writing a record, our next record. And it literally, he comes out for about 6 weeks at a time and we practice every single day for 5 to 6 hours a day. So we kind of make up for the missing Monday night practices.
Black flag. So this is some more music.
his life was like a fart, you know? First part. Second part.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show. Speed Turning Light. Something from Steve McKay and the Blue Prostitutes. Live on WFMU. Steve McKay, of course, sax man for Stooges. And I got to play with him last month in Memphis. I made an album with him. No guitar, no keyboard. Just two sax, clarinet, trumpet, drummer, and bass. Yeah, trippy thing. And first time I got to record Memphis. So it was a neat thing for me. After that, we heard Person Who's Dead by Spielgusher. A new album. I'm on with Shimi Mizuko, Tokyo, and Mr. Richard Meltzer, of course. I found the original lyrics that he gave. Let me show you. People, you can't see this on the... You can't see this on the radio, but these things had been missing for, I don't know, almost 30 years. Richard Meltzer was going to collaborate with the Minutemen, and he wrote his 10 songs. I found the original lyrics.
Wow.
And actually,
wow,
9 of the 10 made it to the Spielgusher album after all these years. You know, I always wanted to kind of realize that thing that we were going to do, because these big hero me and bones. Yeah, I found them. I put them up on the Hoot page. You can see them up on the Hoot page. I made scans of them. But after all this time, I saw them again, and there's some little changes. For the most part, 9 of the 10 poems that we were going to do as Minutemen with him ended up at the Spielgusher album. And then we heard What Goes In Quiet Comes Out Loud by the Dogs. Dogs was from the old days. I've seen them Starwood. And then Danse Sociale by Frontenac Chateau Baby. Frontenac Chateau Baby is a line in a Blue Oyster Cult song, which Richard Meltzer used to write lyrics for that band, but he didn't write those lyrics. But it's in this song called The Red and the Black that I've done since I was 13 with different people. Back to your story here, the Terremelos. I get to meet you guys and play with you guys in Japan. So there's a connection that way that you had made with the guys I did. I met them through Patrick Nesbitt, a guy from Ireland, who via England set up a little label and brought those cats on tour. We're talking about the band Light. I heard they're recording a new record right now.
But the Japan thing, I remember hearing, because we had that Japan tour booked with Light. Awesome band, awesome dudes. And I remember getting an email or something from one of those guys, or Kazuto, saying that it's looking like Mike Watt and the Missing Men were going to be on those shows with us, and our minds were just blown. It was completely surreal and exciting, and we couldn't believe that we were going to be playing in Japan with you and Light and touring, and that was a really, really, like, happy, like, fun moment for us, realizing that was going to happen.
That was pretty wild. And it was in a place which was very scary for us, because we were trying to learn that fucking piece. We know it now. We know that motherfucker inside out. But in those days, those were the first 14 gigs of that motherfucker, and it was brutal. There was so much to remember. Now I know it in my sleep, you know, but at that time, it was like we had to pound that motherfucker into our muscles, into our brains, into everything. Especially me, man. That was an embarrassing time. I remember for the first one was at that Super Deluxe in Roppongi, and god damn. I shit a pecan log. I shit you not. That was intense. That was rough. So, there's another phase of the band we should talk about. Because you guys became a four-piece for gigs.
Right, okay, so when we put out our last, we did our record with John, our first record with him,
yeah.
Patagonian Rats, that came out in September of 2010.
Right.
And it was so layered with elements, samples, extra guitar, extra vocals. This was our first record with proper vocals done on it. So it was a really, like, deep album with lots of stuff going on it. So in order to accurately represent what we had recorded, we brought along a good friend of ours, this guy Evan Jewett, who plays in a lot of bands that we've toured with and hung out with.
Oh, Evan, I've played a lot of his Worker Bee on the show.
Right, Worker Bee.
San Jose guy.
Yep, that's them. And so he joined the band, and we called it the Patagonian Rats Band. And he played for about a year. He toured for about a year with us, contributing, you know, guitar, vocals, samples, as an auxiliary member.
Yeah.
And so now, fast forward to where we're at now, he, you know, had his own thing to go back to. So he's not currently touring with us anymore, and we're back down to the three-piece. We reconfigured everything.
You're making this new album.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So, streamlined once again.
Very interesting journey, though, man. I can't wait to hear the new stuff. If you had advice for somebody getting started with music, what would you tell them?
Whoa. Well, the one thing that I wish I would have picked up on a lot earlier into my musical journey would just be the idea of creating things and, like I had mentioned, starting a band, writing your own music, and, you know, carving out your own path versus, you know, just kind of aimlessly wandering, playing guitar because it's, you know, you're trying to impress a girl or something, or whatever reasons people pick up a guitar for these days or have always done it for. But, yeah, I think people should be aware of, you know, creating and kind of doing their own thing musically.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that's kind of hard to figure out when you're starting. And it takes maybe kind of living some life to figure that out. Because I look back and I go, I can't believe we were just fucking in the bedroom copying them goddamn records. You know? You know, but that's why I'm always amazed. Sometimes some people's journeys, they actually did start really early. And it just blows me away. Like, how did you guys stumble onto that? It took us... Not only a period of time, it took a fucking whole movement to kick us in our ass. So I think you guys, you're a righteous example of finding your inner voice and bringing it out there. And much respect. I really look to a band like Terra Melos and yourself, too, as a guitar man, as inspiring to me. And in fact, I look forward to getting to play with you with Yeah, Mr. Greg, Mr. Nels, and Big Walnuts Yonder. We're going to have to put it off a little bit until the Wilco machine creaks in a gap there. I think it'll be sometime in the summer, I think. He's working on it big time. He really is.
Yeah.
He's just all jammed up against the wall, and he was very honored that, you know, you asked. So it's going to be a righteous project. And that's what it's all about in a lot of ways. It's just getting initiative. And when Mr. Nick here asked me to ask him, I said, shit, yeah. Fucking bitching. We're going to have a good old time. You're making your thing now because I got the 8 tunes done. I'm wondering if I should flow on you now or should I hold off and wait for you to get your caramelos going.
I say you flow on me second. Oh yeah, okay. I'm eager to get started on it.
Yeah, he says it's trippy for him because coming from the bass end is kind of weird, so that'll be trippy.
Yeah,
I want to thank you, Mr. Nick Reinhardt, for being guest on Watt for Pedro show. You're an example of why me and D Boone and Georgie started playing 30 years ago, and or even before that, but. The spirit wasn't just for the old days. You guys keep it alive in your own way, which is only right. So thank you for being on the show, and keep on keeping on. Good luck with the new album.
Thank you.
It's been the February 14th, 2012 Watt from Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.